Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I like sucking.
Legit bad podcast.
Welcome to Costco. I love you.
Welcome back to Legit Bat Podcast. Today we have Terry Lovelace on. He is the author of The Incident at Devil's Den and his new book coming out, The Incident at Devil's Den, The Reckoning. Ominous title. We got into neither of his books, really. More of just some crazy stories that he has collected over the years.
But I disagree. I'm sorry. We got into both of his books, just a touch, though.
Oh, yeah. Some random stories from him.
He definitely touched on Incident at Devil's Den and Incident at Devil's Den, The Reckoning. He just, you know, I don't know. It wasn't like a long synopsis. It was just little stories here and there.
Yeah. He has some qualifications, though. He sent me his bio. It says he's been a lifelong experiencer since early childhood. You'd have to read his book to get more into that, but he had 6 years of active duty from 73 to 79 in the Air Force as a medic and first responder. While on active duty, him and his friend Toby were abducted from an Arkansas state park while remote camping in June of 77. They suffered burn injuries from the abduction and harsh scrutiny from the OSI of the Air Force. After he enlisted, he completed a bachelor's degree in psychology from Park University. His legal career included private practice in Michigan, and later appointed as an assistant attorney general for the state of Vermont, where he served until his retirement in 2012. After that, he published his book, probably for obvious reasons. You don't want to be in that kind of a field and publish a crazy story about getting abducted.
That was his whole point. He published his book after his career because he didn't want to be scrutinized and, you know, taken away from everything that he was doing.
Well, I mean, that's the general rule of politics. Don't do anything while you're still in your political seat if they can bring it back on you. And since we live in a nation where everything you've ever done is brought back on you one way or another, it makes a lot of sense that he wouldn't publish something that could tie him to any kind of thing like that while he was still in a position of doing anything.
Oh, yeah, especially since during the interview he said he was a targeted individual. So,
oh, I'm sure.
There's some eyes on him. He talks about helicopters scoping out his place, and even had a couple. Edgar Casey, was that the guy he had over?
No, it was
there's so many names, I can't remember all of them. Anyway, he had a dude over that just to check out the helicopters that were buzzing his house.
He was so after his.
And what did the guy say? Wait, what did the guy say? I wasn't there for any of the stories. So the guy he had over to check out the helicopters, scoping out his place. What did that guy have to say about the helicopters?
He was like, I get it. None of the helicopters came over the first 2 days he was there, and then at the very end, it was like 4 p.m. the day the guy was gonna leave, and he's like, okay, gotcha. Like, nope, you're totally legit.
He said he has almost 200 pictures of the helicopters over his house, and they're missing the numbers. You know how aircraft are supposed to have numbers?
Yeah.
Apparently, these helicopters are missing their identifying numbers. And he looked it up, and the only thing exempt from that is federal agents.
No, so you're right, Ben. So they're supposed to have an N, like a giant N, as in Nancy, and then all of the numbers after that. No, just N, and then after that, whatever, like these particular helicopters. And he said they had zero numbers on them. So he's an attorney. He was an attorney until he might even still be an attorney to this day. But so he looked up the code for those helicopters, and it said these helicopters are supposed to have the letter N on them. It's supposed to be this length and this width, and it's supposed to be displayed at this whatever. And so he was like, oh, okay. And then at the very bottom of the code, it said, oh, exemption, federal military equipment. And like, it's just like a very vague like thing where it's like, oh, no, it's fine.
Well, helicopters are kind of a big deal in the UFO community. They always seem to pop up after or around an abduction. I know you're not as well versed in this stuff as we are, but they, especially black helicopters, always tend to end up like hovering or following people, along with the Men in Black, but that's, again, a different episode. But I think you'll actually enjoy listening to this one, because Terry's got some crazy stories. TerryLovelace.com. You can find his books on Amazon. So enjoy the chat, and we will see you next week. The incident at Devil's Den. I know you've rehashed it.
Do you mind talking about it? Yeah, do you mind talking about it a little bit?
No.
Just kind of just
love
quick. Oh, okay, great.
It doesn't have to be quick. Just run through whatever, you know, efficient way that you've, you know, found to tell this story, this crazy story, that you actually have to read the book to get all the juicy details.
Well, on your bio, I know on your website, you go right up until the moment you guys are in the tent, and then you're like, oh, okay, this happened, and then you stop there. On the bio. So, and we've obviously read past that, but I was looking at your bio today and I was like, whoa, this is the whole book. One thing that I had forgotten about from the book was the monkey men from your childhood, all the childhood experiences you had when you were little. And that I completely had forgotten about that, that it kind of followed you your whole life. And even into last year, like it's, they marked you. I mean.
Yeah. You know, the guys, are you familiar? Oh, the echo's back. Weird.
Ah.
Do you guys know the TTSA guys, To the Stars Academy?
Yeah.
Phil Elizondo,
Tom,
Steve
Tom
Justice,
DeLong, yeah.
Yep, yep.
Hal Putoff, you know, the whole gang.
Yeah.
Tom DeLong called me in May of 2018 and said, you know, we'd like to take a look at your x-rays, because I have the original x-rays.
Yeah.
And I sent them to him, and we had a long talk on the phone, and he sent a medical doctor down to Dallas, who spent 2 days with me. Nice guy. He asked me not to use his name, so I respect that, and I won't.
No worries.
But he's also a federal agent, so he was able to get from the Dallas VA. Dallas VA gave me a hassle getting my x-rays. They did not want to give them to me. So I'm like, look, guys, I know how to do this. I'll take you to federal court in Dallas, and you know, and I'll raise hell, and I will get my x-rays. So they gave me two. Come to find out, they took 24 shots.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So this doctor from TTSA was able to get like a dozen other films and was able to triangulate them and tell exactly how deep these things were in my knee, which was kind of cool. And then Lou Elizondo came out and spent 2 days with me. I had had, and this sounds really cliche, man, but it's true. I had these helicopters buzzing our house, military helicopters. I took pictures of them, trying to get the numbers off of them so I could identify who was harassing me. Because it really was harassment. I mean, they would do donuts over my house.
And, yeah.
You know. So Lou wanted to see that. So he came and spent 2 days and filmed my story. And he, of course, the 2 days he was there, none of them showed up until the evening of the second day. We went in the late afternoon, went to a restaurant, Mexican restaurant near my house. And it's on a main drag of Garland, a long main drag. And we're coming out of the restaurant about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, late afternoon. And as we're walking to our cars, here is a huge olive drab military helicopter, probably doing 200 miles an hour, 400 feet off the ground, right up the middle of the street, right over our heads. And Lou's like, I get it now. I got it.
Wow.
So, did you ever try to take any pictures of them? Or
I have 168 pictures of them.
Damn.
They were around for like 7 months, and they would come 3 times a week. And they come usually 9 a.m. in the morning, between 9 and 11, when usually the outside of my old home, there was the sun was here and a huge tree was here. So my line of sight was limited to like 180 degrees in back of me. But I got, man, I got pictures of helicopters like crazy. And, you know, I looked up the law because I remember a little bit about aviation law. I knew where to go to look it up. And it says that helicopters must display the alphabetical character N, like Nancy.
Yeah.
And it's got to be so many inches tall, so many inches wide. And then it's followed by a numerical sequence that identifies that particular aircraft. And I took pictures of this stuff, and none of these helicopters had any numbers lettering on them whatsoever. None.
Wow.
And at the bottom of the law, at the bottom of the code, there's an exemption. An exemption for, it just says federal agencies.
Huh.
So
they were, that's pretty vague.
Federal agents. Crazy. Pretty vague, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. It just makes me wonder what's really going on. I mean, there's so much.
Did you guys hear about Haim Ashed, the guy from Israel?
No.
Oh my God, this is huge news.
Oh, yeah, the former Israeli military guy that was saying that he talked to a galactic space agency.
Oh, yeah, that's just from a couple days ago.
Yeah. My daughter told me that. Oh, really?
Yeah, I have friends in Israel who tell me that this guy is, like, ultra-respected. He's been a general in charge of all their space stuff, and then a university professor.
So
10 years.
What I thought was weird about that particular story is that he came out and said, we've been in contact, the gist of it was that we've been in contact with the Galactic Federation, but that humans aren't ready yet. So why are you coming out and telling us about it then if we aren't ready yet? I thought that was really strange.
Probably because he thinks humans should probably be ready. It's not his choice.
But he, in the process of telling us that they're in contact with aliens, he was saying humans aren't ready yet. It's like, so why would you tell us that then?
It's the very next sentence. It's the very next sentence after that when he states that humans aren't ready to comprehend the nature of, I'm quoting, space and spacecraft.
Yeah.
That struck me as a really odd thing to say. What is it about the nature of space and spacecraft that would wig us out, you know, cause riots in New York and Tokyo or something? I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not what we're taught. It's not what we think it is. Well, it's something completely different, whether we're being farmed or whether we're in a simulation or what. I mean, I don't know. I'm not claiming to know, but it's something that is clearly something that would completely freak a lot of people out.
There's a lot of weird speculation the last couple of years, especially about what space actually is. And what do you think it is? Because there's people that think it's actually more of a liquid and that there's some kind of barrier. And we're kind of like almost in a snow globe type of idea. But with your experience, I think you'd probably have your own unique perspective on that.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I've been fortunate in that I call her my handler, Betty. I called her Sue when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I think that they've given me tidbits of information. And what I've been told is that space is a living organism.
Whoa.
And if you think about it, you know, we can only see 5% of the universe. I mean, everything that we see, all the stars, all the galaxies, dogs, cats, cars, everything, with microscopes, telescopes, whatever, is only 5% of the universe because they can measure it. They know how much is there.
Yeah.
So 95% of what's out there, we can't see or even detect.
Yeah.
All we can do is we can identify that it's there because of the effect that it has on other celestial bodies.
Yeah.
So, man, I mean, we're like Helen Keller, you know, we,
yeah, totally.
We don't have the ability to perceive what's out there. But yeah, I've been told that it's a interconnected living thing and that it's organic and that some of the ships that they come here in are actually alive, are actually sentient living things.
I've heard that a couple times too, and that the ships themselves are organic and that they're controlled. Some of them could be controlled, I guess, by themselves,
I mean,
but
it's like riding
other
a
ones
robotic,
do have passengers.
It's like riding a robotic horse in the Western times. I mean, it's like, that's your robotic horse.
But so, you know what? When I think about his comment about understanding the nature of space and spaceships, that was the first thing to cross my mind, is that people would be wigged out because of that. I don't know why they would be wigged out about that. I'm not wigged out about that.
I'm not wigged out about anything anymore, especially after this year. Nothing's going to surprise me. You could tell me space is the brain of God, and I'd be like, well, it kind of makes sense, I guess.
Yeah, I'll buy that. Yeah,
yeah, right. So I thought, Sue or Betty, I thought she told you at the end of your book, Incident at Devil's Den, that you would never be abducted again, that you wouldn't be taken again, and you wouldn't be hurt again. So do you still...
Exactly what she told me.
She did. So why... She said, do you still see her?
You know what? I have weird dreams. I got that echo back again.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I have weird dreams, and I can't say that I've had... I have. November 21st of 2019, I was in my study here writing, and I could detect motion to my left, and I felt that calm sensation wash all over me. And I turned my head to the left, and she was there, and this was only the second time that the entity Betty had visited me. And she told me that the world is about to change, that on February 1st, changes will take place, and that there'll be, the United Nations will be visited by extraterrestrials on February 1st.
Of 2020?
And of 2021.
Oh.
Pardon,
oh.
Of 2020. Of 2020.
Oh, okay.
This year.
Yeah, okay.
And she said then on February 2nd, it will be a new world. Now, I took that to be a positive thing when it happened. And this whole interaction lasted about 30 seconds. But what's crazy is, you guys know Whitley Strieber, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a week with Whitley in June of last year at a Lakota Indian reservation in South Dakota for it was weird. There were no public attendees. There were just experiencers. We were the guest of Chief Dallas Eagle is his name, and his wife, Becky. And on their reservation, they had a problem with UFOs scaring their horses, scaring their children, scaring their tribal members. And they wanted us there to talk to them and explain to them what we know about this stuff and see if we can explain it and help them to understand it so that they won't be so afraid. And we saw a UFO. Of course, it's crazy. We were watching some tribal dancers 2 o'clock in the afternoon who were putting on a show for our benefit. And there was a white disc in the sky, pretty high up because it was small, but it was crystal clear. There were no clouds to speak of. And it was this perfect white circle, and it was standing perfectly still. And we watched it. We all watched it for maybe 20 minutes. Some people have pictures of it. And then it ejected like this black mist. Like a gas or something, and then it just shrunk down and evaporated. Boom, it was gone. So
you think
we
it's
all
a,
had
it,
really crazy experiences.
Do you think so it just disappears like that, or you think it's zipping off so fast it looks like it disappears? Because I've heard both, but I think
you know it could have been either.
Yeah,
because really, I mean, if it went up at you know, 2,000 miles an hour, it would have the same illusion of it shrinking down and disappearing. So
right.
I guess it could be either.
So with what you know, how do you explain to those people that it's okay? I mean, they wanted you to explain, you with your experiences that you've had, which are terrifying, to explain what you know and calm these people down. How do you do that when you know that it's terrifying?
Well, and that's what I said. And I said, well, look, you know, and, you know, over 40 years, my anger's kind of subsided. I'm not as angry with them as I used to be. I don't, you know, want to take a gun and shoot them necessarily now, but I can, you know, because I really don't think, I think the injuries that we suffered were probably more like collateral damage. I mean, it wasn't intended to be a torture session. It was just...
It's like they knew that you would be okay in the end. And they're like, calm down. You're going to be fine.
Yeah. My friend Toby was not so fine.
I know. Well, yeah.
And he didn't fare.
Well, he took all the pills.
He was poor guy was a mess. But of course, I'm not sure if they poisoned us or if maybe the Air Force may have poisoned us. I think I mentioned in my book about this, those pills they sent us home with.
Oh, yeah.
And I go into that in great detail in this new book that's coming out. And I also explain what happened to Toby and how I went about trying to find him. And it's an interesting story. FBI agent. I was working in the law in the 80s, and I had this case that involved the FBI. And I got to know this agent pretty well. And we used to, on Friday nights after work, you know, meet at the bar and have a couple beers and talk. And I asked him one night, I said, hey, can you help me find this friend of mine I was in the Air Force with? And he said, sure, I can find anybody as long as they're not a fugitive. No, that's supposed to be a joke. That's FBI humor, because that's what they do. They hunt for fugitives, right?
So, yeah.
So it wasn't funny, but I laughed anyway, you know, and he laughed at his own joke. But he said, yeah, I can find your friend, I think. And he told me to bring him everything, write down on a piece of paper, everything that I could remember about him, you know, parents' names, addresses, anything that would help me find the guy, help, you know, be of help. So I did. And it's amazing how much you can remember about someone when you work night shift with them for 3 years. So I brought him, you know, a couple sheets of paper typed up and put it in an envelope and dropped it off at his office. And about 2 weeks later, he called me up and he says, meet me at the bar. I got some info on your buddy. And I'm like, great, yeah, see you there. So I get there at the normal time. He's like 10 minutes late, and he walks in all somber looking. And he comes over and he says, I got bad news for you, Terry. Your friend is dead. And I said, he's dead? What do you mean he's dead? He's a young man. How can he be dead? And he says, it was an automobile accident on Highway 94 out of Flint. He said, it was a head-on collision. He said, stuff happens, Terry. You know, we're human beings. We're mortal. It happens. And you know that it happens. And I'm very sorry. But, you know, pick up your life and go on with it. So I did. And, you know, I could very easily, because I was practicing in Michigan at the time, I very easily could have gone to the Michigan State Police headquarters in East Lansing and look for the accident report. And I didn't do that. I just took his word for it. And when I was writing the book in 2017, I decided I wanted to look up his obit, and I was thinking about finding his gravesite and maybe making a run up to Michigan. So I found out I did find his obit, but he didn't die until September 1st, 2007.
Huh.
So this FBI agent lied to me.
Whoa.
I mean, he had to lie to me, because, I mean, I couldn't see him. All the FBI agents I knew were stand-up people. I mean, they really were very smart, very articulate, very, you know, just very smart people. And just not the kind of people that would lie to you. So,
well, we have a general...
Do you think his hand was maybe forced? Like, do you think he was a little forced? I mean, based on what you know and, like, what you were putting out there, do you think maybe he was gotten to... And someone said, hey, tell this guy this happened and let him go on his merry way.
Yeah, I think that. As a matter of fact, the guys from TTSA told me that there's a file somewhere. They told me that I'm a targeted individual. Had you guys ever heard the term before?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, okay, yeah, I'm not surprised at all.
I'm a targeted individual.
For sure.
They also said that there's a file somewhere that the FBI would look up on me that would probably have a note in it. Keep these two guys apart, you know. Two people together makes a story much more credible than one person.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the fact that they separated you guys immediately after you had your experience. They separated you, said you couldn't talk to each other, your wives couldn't talk to each other, right?
That's right. That's right. And that's not unusual. You know, I put that email address in the back of my book, Devil's Den. And I said, look, if you've had an experience, I'm not a doctor or therapist, but, you know, send me an email and tell me about it. Well, since March of 2018, I've received 1,400 plus emails.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So, and there's a core group of about 400 of those emails that are just incredible stories. I mean, just would blew me away. And
were any of them similar to yours? I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. Were any of them so similar to yours that they...
Unbelievably similar.
Wow.
Unbelievable. The commonalities are just insane. And I've got, you know, I got people from South Africa, from Australia, a lady from Austria. I got, you know, people all over the world. My book sells in 11 countries.
Wow.
And they all have, I mean, irrespective of the country, they all just commonalities. Like, for instance, I felt this odd feeling that I couldn't reconcile that I really didn't want anything to do with Toby after this.
Huh.
And I had trouble understanding that because this guy was my best friend. But and I did go to see him one time before, you know, violated orders and went and saw him. And it was very uncomfortable. It was a very uncomfortable feeling. But I found out that people tell me that they witnessed something in a group of friends or even a bunch of family members. And nobody will talk about it. And if there's a group of friends that see this, the band of friends will disband and everybody will go their separate ways. And there's a great explanation or example of this. There's a group called the Allagash Four, from four guys that took a fishing trip off the Allagash River in Maine. They were twin brothers, and then two other guys. They were college age at the time. And they went on this fishing trip. And this is a very famous case. They've been on television. They've been hypnotized and regressed, and they have amazing stories, so very similar to mine. But what they did was they wanted to night fish. So they were on the lake, and they built this humongous bonfire. I mean, you know, a bonfire that would burn for, you know, 8 hours. And they built it on the shore because that way, while they're out in the middle of the lake, they can't get lost. They can always use that as a beacon to find their way back to their campsite. So as they're rowing out, they see a light. And one guy says, is that the moon? And they're looking at that. No, that's not the moon. And they saw this huge white glowing object get closer and closer to them. And it lit up the whole inside of the canoe. And they were all terrified. And then, boom, memory gone. They black out. Their next memory is they're all rowing toward what's left of the campfire. And the campfire is just embers. And it's just breaking dawn.
Wow.
So they got back to the campsite and nobody said a word. Nobody said a word about what happened. Did you see what I saw? And that's human nature to debrief, you know. And they didn't do any of that. They went to bed, you know, like Toby and I did.
Yeah.
And then afterward, even the twins grew apart. And finally, one of the twin brothers called the other and said, man, I'm having these crazy dreams about that fishing trip. And his brother admitted, I'm having the exact same dreams. And that's when they consulted a psychiatrist and looked into hypnosis and found out they'd been abducted.
That is a wow. Weird thread that kind of seems common with these when there's shared abductions, that these people, they don't want to talk about it or they act like it didn't happen.
Yeah, that's what you said in your book.
That especially the ones that are on the road when they're driving, the classic, you know, you're driving down a deserted highway and there's a light, your car stops working. There's so many stories like that, and almost all of them, the people just kind of go, eh, whatever, let's keep driving.
Yeah, there's like a weird apathy, yeah. Like you said in the book. It's like an apathetic, oh, okay, no big deal. This happens all the time. It's fine.
Disinterest? Yeah, it's just crazy. Well, I think that that demonstrates the influence that they have over us.
It's terrifying, that influence, that they can control our emotions, to control our actions. That's absolutely terrifying. That, I mean, I guess it just makes me want to do mind exercises every day, because it's absolutely terrifying what they could do. They could make us zombies at any time. I mean, honestly.
Well, if they have that kind of control, they could basically do whatever they want. We couldn't stop it.
But that's what they do. I mean, according to your story, people don't remember these abduction experiences. And what you said, Sue or Betty would calm you. And I've heard, we've researched this stuff. I mean, we've heard a lot of different stories, but there's usually an entity that will calm the person through like mind control, where they send a calm over them while they're being basically tortured or prodded or poked or experimented on. And they're just, and there's something going into them where it's like, oh no, it's totally fine. And they're maybe internally, you know, freaking out, but they don't freak out because those beings don't want them to freak out.
It's almost like a mental morphine.
The being was pissed at you because you were freaking out. You were, you know, hey, stop doing this. And the thing was mad. It was like, why are you freaking out? Stop it.
Yeah. Why are you screaming? Stop screaming. You know, we take you home. You know, we don't hurt you. Now stop screaming.
Yeah, but you're like, but it hurts now, dude. I live in the moment. I'm a human.
Yeah.
It's like giving a dog a shot. You're like, calm down. You're going to be fine when we get you home.
Yeah, and we do that. We do that to animals, though. Like, we do that currently. We're like, calm down. We're just branding you, cow. Just, you're going to go back in the field. That's how I feel like we are to these things a little bit.
I think so, too. You know what? I've got a good example about that. And let me get into the story a little bit.
Yes.
And tell you some things that didn't make it into the book.
Okay.
In my new book, I've got a chapter about my cousin. I had a cousin from Arkansas who was having the same time I'm undergoing this stuff with the monkey men as a kid. He's undergoing this thing with clowns in his room.
Ooh, that's worse.
I guess they thought a circus theme suits the Lovelace family for some reason. That's a very interesting story. It's a very interesting true story. And I put that in. So I think people will find that interesting. But one of the things I know that I didn't put in there was the 6 foot tall guy with a pinkish gray complexion. I had no cartilage, so he had no ears, no nostril, pardon me, just nostrils, no nose, just
skin and bones.
He looked ET-like. He was humanoid, but he looked ET-like, and that he had no ears, no nose, just a slit for a mouth, two nostrils, sparse hair, and his complexion, like I said, was an odd color. It was a whitish pink.
Ugh.
And and
he had, like, the communion cover,
the black eyes. Yeah, he had these, you know, they weren't like huge exaggerated like in the motion pictures. These were like a pair of wraparound Ray-Bans.
Ugh.
Yeah. Okay.
It's almost worse.
And it was, I noticed him because the only thing I could move was my eyes. I couldn't, when I was standing there holding my clothing in my hands, and we're in like this huge atrium of this thing, and Toby's to my left. And I noticed this guy. There were a lot of the little gray guys running around all over the place, but there was this one guy who was 6 foot tall. So he stood out. And he was closer to me, so I could kind of see. I could see that he was wearing like a V-neck sweater kind of garment. I didn't see any insignia of rank or anything on it. I couldn't see what kind of footwear he had because there were people in the way or little gray guys in the way. But he's to my left, and I'm straining my eyes to the left as far as I can. And he turned his head, and just by happenstance, we locked gaze. And the second we locked eyes, and of all the things that happened to me in a ship, this was the scariest thing. And this is the thing that plagues my sleep the worst. This guy was in my head. I mean, he knew me. He knew my wife. He knew my secrets. And the example that I give that I should have put in the book and I didn't was when our kids were little, we had a English setter, you know, and, you know, he was just a great family pet. And he would come over and put his head in my lap and I would pet him. And, he would look up at me with those big brown eyes, you know, and just, you know, reflecting loyalty and love and the idea that he knew that I was the alpha, you know.
Yeah.
But I provided him with everything that he needed and love and attention. So I look into his eyes and there was trust. And we each knew our respective roles. When I locked eyes with this guy, I felt like I was the dog in the equation. It was a humbling experience. Whatever this thing was, it was 500 rungs up the evolutionary ladder from us, because I felt just incredibly inadequate as a human.
Wow.
I thought,
How long did that whole experience
last? Like, you felt no love from it, or did it...
Seconds.
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry, what was your question?
Like, you felt no love from it or no respect from it in any way? It was just like...
No. It was, you know what it was? It was raw intellect. That's what mirrored back from those eyes.
Like an AI type of thing.
Well, it's like us looking at a group of ants.
Yeah, maybe so.
Just like, eh.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, they probably think of us as like somewhere between mold in a petri dish and, you know, a lab rat.
I think there's some of them, though. It's weird. Like, even the hybrids, maybe Betty, Sue, but the hybrids seem to have some sort of kindness towards us, some sort of empathy.
Unless it's programmed in.
No, I mean, they're part of us. I mean, if they're half human and half whatever they are, they can kind of understand, like, okay, like, I kind of get that you feel this way.
No, that is weird, though, the Petri dish analogy, because if a Petri dish could look back up at a human under, you know, looking at it under a microscope, that's all it would notice is pure intellect. The Petri dish wouldn't be noticing any emotion from the human looking at it, you know, through the microscope. So it could be, we could be that far detached from this.
And what's scary is, you know, it's easy to discard a Petri dish in a trash can and not give it two thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah, same with plants.
Or really worry about what that fungi is feeling at any particular time. You're just scraping it and prodding it and throwing it away.
We don't understand how it processes anything, so we're just like, oh, you're not the same as me. Bye. We'll start again.
Yeah.
That's what scares me about it. But we move and talk and we have a language and they see us do that. I guess that's my problem with the whole, you know, alien, if they're abducting us and they see that we move and talk and they move and talk in a similar manner, I mean, they have two arms, two legs, similar face. I'm not saying that they're the same as us, but they look a little bit similar, more similar than we do to plants. And they just discard us like we're a plant or a petri dish. I just don't understand that we look so similar and they won't take the time. I think we should take the time to understand a petri dish or a plant. I'm a weirdo. I'm very interested in the biology of plants and how they think and feel. I think that's a whole different thing. But we are so similar to them, and they won't even take the time to understand our language or our emotions.
That's what makes me think they're not entirely physical, and that maybe the way that you see them or we, however you see any of these weird phenomenon, is how they want us to see it.
No, but if that was the case, they would just... But they could make themselves look way more like us then and not be as terrifying.
Well, they don't really care either.
that's an interesting point, and I've given that a lot of thought, and I don't have an answer, and that is, you know, because I know that the entity that I know as Sue is the same entity that I knew as... The entity I call Betty is the same entity that I knew as Sue when I was between 4 and 7 years old, and they used to take me. And... I had this strong maternal feeling for her. Now, you know, is that programmed? I know they can influence me. Is that programmed into me? Or is that I feel like it's a genuine feeling that originates, you know, from me.
Yeah.
Because she has always, especially when I was a kid, I remember her being kind to me.
She was kindest to you during your hardest moments, though. She was there for you when you were being terrified as a child. Being abducted, she was kind of like there for you. She was like your liaison between these things and also like comforting. I mean, it was like the only thing you had.
It was. And but you know, when I was taken in 1977, I thought to call for Sue, mentally at least, and Sue never came. So in that regard, she let me down. But you know, who knows the hierarchy here? I mean, maybe that was not in her pay grade. Maybe that was not in her purview or her, you know.
For sure. I mean, yeah, I would be willing to bet she wasn't allowed. They're like, no, we have this one.
You know what? Let me, I can go through Devil's Den, the sighting of the thing, but you know what? I've got a couple of really cool stories that are in my book.
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever you want to talk about, man.
And, absolutely.
Yeah, let me say, I had, I condensed these 1,400 emails down to about 400.
I was just going to ask you if you wanted to talk about some of these emails. So yes, please do.
I would love to share these stories because yes. they are so cool. Matter of fact, I call them cases because that is the way I think. And case number one is from this lady from Henderson, Nevada, who sent me an email. And all of these people, I'm not going just by an email. I've established contact with them. We've talked on the phone. Some of these people I've met in person. So I tried to vet them as best that I could to make sure, because some of the people, you know, weren't real consistent with the stories. And
sometimes it's pretty easy to tell which ones are just spinning yarns too.
Sorry.
Yeah, it is. So this woman is 77 years old, living in Henderson, Nevada. She read my book, sent me an email and said, my husband, Paul, my ex, or, you know, her deceased husband, and I had this experience in 1968. And I wrote her back and I said, yeah, I'd love to hear your story. So she sent me an email and said that she was married to a guy, a gentleman named Paul, and they were they were just recently married in 1968. He was a nephrologist, a kidney doctor, and she had completed a degree in liberal arts, spine arts, something. And her job was she stayed at home and did charity work. That was what she did. What they did was they lived in Las Vegas. Henderson really wasn't, I don't think, built at that time. So they lived in Las Vegas. Her husband worked at the hospital in Las Vegas. But they had friends in Reno. And she had a sister in Reno. So once a month, they would drive from Las Vegas to Reno to visit their friends. And they always took the same route. There really was only one route. And I forget the name of the highway. It's still there. The trip is like 240 miles. And she said that her husband, Paul, had they went on an anniversary trip to France, and they bought a Peugeot automobile. Which I thought was kind of cool. She said, yeah, it was a really unique car. It was, you know, her husband's toy. And it really was a unique car. So she had a picture of it, actually. It was very cool. So they had planned a trip, their monthly trip to Reno. And Paul got tied up at the hospital. They would normally leave around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But because of him getting tied up with something, they didn't get to leave until 6, and they thought about canceling their trip, but they already had a room reserved, and they were like, well, you know, we can sleep in the next day. What difference does it make? You know, run into a little traffic, but we can live with it. So they made their trip at night. And the halfway point between Las Vegas and Reno, there is a like gas station, restaurant, truck stop kind of thing.
The classic horror movie setting. Yeah.
And it's still there. It's called the Stagecoach. They would stop there and get gas and fuel. And this night they did. They stopped there. They got gas. They ate a big meal and went out, and they got back in their car and they headed north and west to head to Reno. They were 10 miles outside of city limits of Tunapah is the name of the town. T-O-O-N-A-P-A-H, Tunapah. So they're 10 miles outside city limits. And Tunapah's a little bitty place, right? And they're driving, and they see on the right-hand side of the road this Christmas store. And she says, I was shocked because I had never seen a store before devoted strictly to a holiday. So that was just, she'd never seen a store devoted to Christmas before. And she said that this store sat back from the road a ways, and she said the thing was just insanely lit. It was just light pouring out of every window, and there were strings of Christmas lights wrapped around it, and some are twinkling, and some are flashing, and some are just static, but it's lit up like crazy, and a big sign that says Xmas over it, and she's like, oh my gosh, you know, and it was like 10 o'clock at night, and she says, she told Paul, please stop. You know, we it looks like they're here. Open. I want to see this. So he's like, sure, kind of grudgingly. So he pulls over to the side of the road, and they're looking, and there's no parking lot. There's just sand and sagebrush in front of this thing. So that's he's like, well, that's weird. Fuck. How do you get in there? And then they notice there are no cars there. And there's no road in back of the place. It's just desert. So they're pulled over to the side of the road. And she doesn't think they lost time, but she said there's just something off about those few minutes, seconds, or however long they had pulled over in front of this place. And Paul said, well, I'm going to get back on the road and see if there's a drive up ahead. But, you know, they already knew that there was no road there. So they ended up heading toward Reno. And she said that it was very strange because she slept. You know, she said her husband works 60, 70 hours a week. So normally that was valuable time that they'd use to talk and catch up. And they didn't talk. She slept all the way to Reno city limits. Huh. And they were out of sorts for the next 24 hours or so. And they didn't really talk about it, but they both admitted later that it was on their minds, and they had a fairly normal visit. And on the way back, they said, well, we're going to stop. It's daylight now. We're going to stop at this place. So they're driving back on a Monday, and there is no Christmas store.
Oh my gosh.
They can't find it. There's nothing there. So, but they're kind of in a hurry to get back. So they don't stop and they go home, and they're both confused. And they start comparing memories. And Paul remembered it as being a wooden structure made out of like aged barn wood. And they both remember that it had a front porch that extended the whole length of the building. And that the inside was insanely lit. And they could see motion inside, but not identify figures. But her memory differs from his in that she recalls it being a brick building. And She admitted to her husband, you know, look, I just can't get this thing off my mind. Why don't we this Saturday, we got nothing on the calendar. Why don't we drive up there again and have lunch and scope this place out? It has to be there. You know, we had to have just drove past it and missed it. So they did. They got up early that next Saturday morning and they drove up there. And according to Olivia, they got there and it, you know, 10 miles past the town, they drove. They drove 15 miles past the town, nothing, turned around, came back the other way, turned around, went back again. Pardon me. And then came back, and there's no Christmas store. And they're both in shock, you know, because they're so certain they knew what they saw. So they went to the stagecoach where there were kind of regulars. They were known there. And they asked the waitress, they said, you know, when did Tunipa get a Christmas store on the highway? And the lady's like, Christmas store? What are you, nuts? I don't know anything about a Christmas store. And she says, well, look, we know what we saw. We saw this new structure, this new business built. And she said, well, why don't you talk to the guy that ran the restaurant? She said his name was Yang. Mr. Yang is the president of the Chamber of Commerce. And she says, he's here. If anybody would know anything about a new commercial structure in Tunipa, it's going to be him. I'll send him over and you guys can talk to him about it. So she said that this Mr. Yang came over and was very courteous, and very kind, and they asked him to join them, and he did, and he gave him a quick history of the town, which wasn't much, and they told him what they saw. And he said, you know, I don't know what you saw, but I know that there's not been a new business registered in Tunipa for 8 months, and that was a florist downtown. There's no new structure built. I would be aware of it. I know it.
Was it a florist that sold Christmas lights, though?
No, it was probably a UFO, no, right? And that was a screen memory.
Screen memory, yeah.
Yeah, it was a UFO they saw.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It was totally absolutely. A UFO. Yeah.
Absolutely. So they go home, and, you know, they spend 40 years having nightmares about a Christmas store.
Wow. You know?
That's and, awful.
And just characteristically, Paul would never talk to her about it. He'd have nightmares, but not discuss them. And their monthly trips to Tunipa turned into like once or twice a year.
Huh.
So kind of ruin the trip for them.
Are you aware of any more stories out of that area of UFO sightings or?
Yes, 1400.
Yeah.
No, I mean out of that specific area though.
Oh, well, a lot of Utah, Nevada, like that area is pretty like high strangeness.
You know, I got a really good similar story. There's the echo again. Really good similar story. I got this email from this woman who is a nurse anesthetist living in Kentucky, and I was able to track her name through the Kentucky Department of Nursing and find out she actually was an RN, and she was registered as a nurse anesthetist. And she was 66 years old. She was getting ready to retire. And she and her partner had moved from, the family was originally in Oklahoma. And after she got out of nursing school, she got a good job in Kentucky. So that's how she ended up in Kentucky. But when she was a little girl, when she was 9 years old, and her younger sister, Molly, was 7, they used to go every year to see their maternal grandparents in kind of western part of Oklahoma. They had a farm there. They had a single oil well, you know, that paid for their college. And they spent 2 weeks there as a vacation every summer. They just loved their grandparents. They were just beautiful people. They had fun. The farm was set up with this long, like a mile-long driveway. And the front yard was just nicely cut, manicured, trees, lots of flowers. And there was a berm made out of dirt with a road on top that bisected the property. It cut across and defined the front yard and then the back. And then over this berm, there was, you know, the farm with the barn and animals and most importantly, a farm pond that was like 12 feet deep. So the girls knew the rules. They could not go over the berm because there was danger back there. And, you know, this is like the fourth year that they can recall going there. So they knew the rules and they were good kids and they weren't being monitored this year. They, you know, normally there would be an adult out there with them while they played. Well, they thought, you know, they're good girls. They know the rules, right? So she says that she and her sister are chasing butterflies and just doing all kinds of fun stuff 7 and 9 year old girls do. And Julia said that she heard calliope music, like a circus. And a calliope, I did a little research on this, and back in the day for like these rural communities in the middle of nowhere, there were these traveling circuses that would have, you know, a couple of exotic animals, and they all had this thing called a calliope, which was a steam-operated type of pipe organ, you know, these long tubes, and they play music on this thing.
Oh, is that the? Is that the thing that's like the doo 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 doo?
Bingo!
Yeah. So, oh, that is terrifying to hear that. Out of context, at least.
But, you know, and she, Julia says, Molly, do you hear that? And that goes back. And they're listening. And she said that they both looked at each other and said, it's a circus, you know. And Molly says to Julia, can we go, Julia? Can we go? Can we go see? Because the noise is coming from, of course, from the other side of the berm. And Julia says, Molly, you know the rules. We have to go ask Grandpa. We can't go over the berm. And Julia, like a good lawyer, says, yeah, but Grandpa didn't say we couldn't go on top and look over the berm.
The law is to be interpreted.
Yes. So Julia says, sure, let's do that, right? You know, they're excited. They want to see what's going on. So they climb the top of this berm, and she's standing on top of this road, you know, the road that, like a dirt road that was used to bring a tractor from point A to point B. And she says that they saw a carousel with the horses. This is very similar to the Christmas story.
Yeah.
That's why I chose it. It's crazy similar to the Christmas story. she said this calliope, or pardon me, this carousel or merry-go-round, whatever you want to call it, with the horses, was like three times bigger than anything they'd ever seen, that it was just to the right of the pond over an area of just dirt, but it's 4 feet off the ground because they can see this noonday sun cast this shadow. They can see this big, perfect shadow underneath the thing. It's not on the ground. It's above the ground. And she said the horses looked to be alive and that the thing was spinning so fast that there's no way that anybody could have got on or off the thing. But she said that it was mesmerizing and they couldn't take their eyes off of it. And they laid back on the berm and they're staring at this thing. And they're holding hands and they're just captivated by it. And she said, just like the Christmas story, she said this thing was covered with a million lights. You know, some twinkling, some not. Sounds familiar. And she recalls that they were happy. You know, they were just really content. And then they were out. So the girls are gone. Grandma and Grandpa come out around this time and yell for the girls to come in, and there's no girls. So they think, oh, my God. And they start running a search. They're calling their names. They're walking around. And just by coincidence, there was this car that made a wrong turn that was going to actually a neighbor's farm, made a wrong turn and came up their long driveway. And Mom and Grandma saw this car turn around as they stepped out on the porch and head back the other way. So they thought, could the girls be kidnapped? You know? So they call neighbors. Neighbors get involved with the search. They call the police. The sheriff's department comes. They find the car. And, of course, it was just a visitor at a neighbor's house. And Grandpa Jeb calls his VFW hall that sends, like, 15 guys down there to help hunt. And then the sheriff pulls the old man aside and says, you know, we need to check the pond. So he makes a call, and two guys show up in a pickup truck towing what he called a John boat. And they had these two long poles. And they got it on the pond, and Julia said that's when her grandparents broke down and had to go inside. And these guys had these, like, 10-foot-long poles, wooden poles, and they would stir up the water in case the girls were in the water. Oof. They would maybe float to the top.
Yeah.
So these guys are out in this John boat, and they're stirring up the water, and the guy that's in, one guy's facing forward, one guy's facing backward, and they're both doing their thing. And the one guy has a view of from his peripheral vision, a view of the backside of the sperm where the girls had laid down. And he says he's sure, he's absolutely certain there was nothing there. And he looks up a millisecond later, and the girls are there. They're both laying there, dry as a bone, holding hands, and sound asleep.
Wow.
So he yells, we got them. We found them. He screams. Everybody comes running. They see the girls. You know, they wake them up. They find out they're not dead. They're actually alive. They're dry. They didn't drown. And everybody is just, you know, crying and happy. And where have you been? Where have you girls been? Well, we don't know. We were watching the merry-go-round thingy, and we went to sleep. So, but what's really interesting is the change in these two girls. Julia, the older one, had got good grades in school up to this point, but had always struggled with math. Well, that autumn when they went back to school, she started off with fractions, and she said it was no problem. She suddenly had this gift, this ability with math that just blew her family away. Not only could she understand it, she liked it. And so she did just terrific at school. Molly, on the other hand, went from being this really outgoing, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of little girl to being kind of sullen and withdrawn. And she said that it was just like whenever they left this farm, that they were two different people. She said that Molly and her were still sisters, but they were never, ever as close as they were that visit. And they never spoke about it. And she said that Molly graduated from high school, married very young, had a string of marriages, was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, treated with medication, and just had a very rough life. Julia, on the other hand, went to nursing school, aced everything. And she says, my only regret is I didn't go to medical school because I'm sure I could have handled that. But she became a nurse anesthetist, which is kind of elitist in the RN profession.
Totally.
And she had a good life, and things went well for her. And in 6 years ago, so that would be, 1994 or so, Molly develops breast cancer. And she takes Family Medical Leave Act time and goes to Oklahoma from Kentucky to see her sister, because her sister is now terminally ill. And she said that she gave her sister palliative care and held her hand and, you know, did all that she could. And she said that for the first time in her life, she asked Molly, Molly, can we talk about what happened at Grandpa Jeb's? And she said, and Molly's on her deathbed. Molly turns her face to the wall and says, no.
Oh, Jesus.
Whoa.
And passes away the next day.
Holy shit.
So they never go through a whole lifetime and never had a chance to compare notes or talk about what happened to them. And this woman also, kind of like me in some ways, has had incredible intuition ever since this thing happened. And she calls it her sixth sense. You know, it doesn't work all the time, but there are times when she'll have flashes of what she referred to as insight. And she thinks that that was a gift. She thinks her math was a gift. What she doesn't understand is, why were they so kind to her, and why did her sister have such a bad outcome from this? And
who knows? I mean, it's probably the same reason you had I wouldn't say awesome, but you dealt with it apparently a lot better than Toby did. I guess it's subjective to the person, you know,
a little bit.
Everybody's different.
What scares me is that they try to trick us with dumbass shit. Like, and I hate saying, I'm sorry, like, excuse my language, but the Christmas store, the merry-go-round, they just are like, oh, you're so petty. We'll trick your eyes with this. Like, it makes me think they just think we're stupid. Like, oh, we'll trick your eyes with this Christmas store.
That's very calculated. That's very calculated and very intentional.
Yes, exactly. That's why it's terrifying.
I got letters, emails from people saying that when they were my age, when they were 4 and 5, they had owls in their room.
Oh, yeah.
They had raccoons. Matter of fact, I got a story in my book about a kid that had a raccoon that would visit him, walked on two legs and spoke to him telepathically.
It's like your monkey men. Orbs, it's the same thing.
Little gray men, Disney characters. I mean, you know, that's like appearing to me as circus monkeys. I think that they assume the form that they think is most, that we would think is most benign.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like Contact with Jodie Foster, when the guy, portrays himself as her father who's passed away. That's what they do. They're just like, oh, what will be the easiest for you to perceive so that I can most easily, gotcha. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, too, because they appear in these disguised forms, they know that no parent's going to believe them.
You know, right.
I would believe my kids, but.
I know. Yeah. I would believe mine too, but we're very like, my parents wouldn't believe me. If I said, hey, the monkey men came to me and they took me outside the house, they'd be like, okay, honey, go back to bed. And it's like these things know that, though. That's the scariest thing. They know how we work. The fact that they know how we work and how our emotions work and still aren't interested in learning more about that and caring and being empathetic to that is what's most terrifying to me. Is that they can,
it is terrifying.
That they can manipulate us in that way and not try to understand us in a good, loving way. And I'm not trying to be a hippy-dippy weirdo, but like, if they know that we are happy about a carousel or a Christmas store, and we just think that's great, and we go have a great time. They can't understand that. They're just going to use it to manipulate us and take us and experiment on us. That's what's terrifying to me. And
it's kind of like a duck decoy.
It is.
It's something they know we want to see, so we're going to go there.
Yeah, that's what makes me think. It makes me think of animals, the way that people hunt, and I'm not against hunting at all. I'm not. If people want to hunt for food, go ahead and do it. I don't care. I don't do it, but people can.
I don't do it, but yeah.
Okay. For sure. Yeah, I'm not against it, but I feel like that's kind of what these things do with us. They don't understand us, so they hunt us or they experiment on us the way that people test shampoo on rabbits or whatever. It's the same thing. Like, we're just that to them.
Yes, Procter and Gamble. Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah. Like, Johnson, that's what we are. But we're so much more. I don't want to say we're so much more intelligent. I shouldn't say that. We don't know how rabbits feel. We don't know how animals are. We don't have any comprehension. So.
I don't know. I'm kind of an animal rights activist kind of guy. Joe, when you walked away, we were talking about, I had mentioned, I don't know, maybe you heard me, the different kinds of echoes back. Every time I mention it, though, it seems to go away.
So. Keep calling it out.
And it's gone. It's gone. Hey, yeah, it's gone now. Yeah. But people were telling me, you know, I saw these little monkeys in my room when I was a kid. I got emails from people that saw rabbits and owls and birds and Disney characters and clowns and little gray guys and glowing orbs. Just a whole bunch of different...
just a smorgasbord of cartoons.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but I think they know what a kid's going to find most benign.
Yeah.
And what the parents are not going to believe.
Yep.
So.
No, it makes sense. Yeah. There's so many of these stories. Ever since I've started looking into this stuff, there's so many of these stories. And the common thing is that how weird it is. It's always bizarre. There's never like, oh, this alien came to me and told me to stop blowing each other up with nuclear weapons. That happens all the time, but it's always something weirder than that, like the monkeys or a carousel, or, you know, there's so many other ones of it crosses over into the paranormal area of people seeing fairies and gnomes and all that stuff. But there'll be a little kid that sees, you know, a little green man in his room and disappears into a hole in the wall. And the more we've talked about this on several episodes, but I think all of it's kind of the same thing. The paranormal, the alien, it all just kind of appears in a different way, but it's all kind of the same thing. And it just appears to different people however they think it should be, you know,
that's what we
shown
were talking
to
about with the carousel and the Christmas star thing.
Well said. I mean, I think, and I got a letter from a lady. I think this stuff, I really have come to think that this stuff is all interrelated on some level. I don't know what level. I don't know what the connection is.
We're on the same page there, yeah.
Who said that she said NDE experiences.
Those are kind of similar too, really weird.
I hope NDE experiences are not the same as alien experiences.
But I kind of... she told me where to go. There's a on YouTube, there are a ton of videos by an organization called IANS, the International Association of Near-Death Studies. And then there's NDE.org. And then there's this medical doctor. He's an oncologist named Jeffrey Long, who did a study of near-death experiences. And, you know, real credible guy. But anyway, what she was telling me was that people in the NDE community, because there's an NDE community, just like there's a UFO community, mm-hmm. and people in this NDE community have had since late 2018 this vague anxiety, like something big was going to happen. And of course, COVID happened. We were talking, and I ended up, we had a long telephone conversation, and she said that, and I don't know much about Edgar Cayce. I read a book about him when I was a kid, but, and I didn't remember this. Edgar Cayce said that that we can reincarnate and onto different planets, that there are inhabited planets out there with intelligent beings, and we're all kind of under the same purview or same God. And when we die, we our souls go through the same, retread system and can end up on another planet.
Just getting recycled. So,
yeah. So.
So I was.
I don't
reading...
know. She. interesting.
Who is this?
This woman emailed me and said that the NDE community, that NDEs, near-death experiences, and the UFO phenomena has something in common. The concepts are related somehow. And then she went as far as to say, if you look closely, you'll find that it's all related. Ghosts, UFOs, all this stuff, cryptids, whatever you want to look at, Bigfoot, yep. It's all related somehow.
Like I said, we've talked about it on several episodes now, but I think it's all one thing, and I think it's all kind of interdimensional, because there's some physicality to some of it, but there's definitely a metaphysical to it too, where things disappear or it looks like a carousel. So there's some kind of physical nature to it, but it's like out of phase, it's like kind of half in, half out.
Yeah.
We don't really have the right human language to describe this kind of thing, because we don't know what the fuck
we're
talking about.
It's like Skinwalker Ranch. Did you read Hunt for the Skinwalker?
I didn't. Some stuff I shy away from, because if I read it, I won't sleep for a week.
So I will say, we bought that book at the exact same time that we bought your book. So we bought those two together, and then Joe read that one while I read yours, and then we flipped, and then we talked about it. But
it was an interesting couple weeks.
Yeah, we were both like, like, what's going on in the world? Yeah, I think it's scary. Like, I don't know what's scarier. So I don't want to think about dying and being dead forever, because as a human, I can't possibly conceive of that. That's horrible. But I can't possibly think of being reincarnated forever and tortured forever. That's awful, too. So, like, what's worse? Being dead forever?
Well, I said those almost the exact same words to this woman. And I said, look, I'm tired, if when it comes time for me to check out, I want some kind of reward, I don't want to be thrown back down here.
Right.
And she says, well, it doesn't work that way. And I'm like, well, tell me about it. How does it work? And she says, well, when you pass over, you'll be greeted. You'll be treated like a king. You'll be happy. You'll be content. And you'll have your time to rest. And
what does that mean?
She told me time to chill for a while, before you have to come back. And she
says
that when you go to come back, that your soul, and I had never heard this before, but evidently this is common belief within the NDE community. She says that your soul will decide if it wants to come back. And then if it makes that decision that it wants to come back, because evidently we learn shit here that we can't learn anywhere else.
Yeah.
Can't learn up there. It's weird. It's like a special place here. Yeah. It's weird. So, I have a friend who had an NDE experience, and I don't know anyone except for this one person. And she told me she died on an operating table and had a random NDE experience that she did not understand at the time. She went in for surgery, and she woke up, and everything was white around her. Like, not white, like white. It was like bright, like light, but not white. Yeah. Does that make sense? And she was just, she was kind of like floating, but she was like, oh shit, I'm dying. Like, oh my God. she knew she had just gone in for a surgery, but she wasn't sure where she was. And then she kind of looked down and saw the doctors working on her, and she saw them arguing. And then she doesn't remember anything else. And then she woke up, and then she talked about how the doctors were arguing, and the nurse confirmed, like, yes, they were arguing, because they were arguing about the treatment. But she said it happened to her twice, where she had to go back in for another surgery, and she was again in this, like, white suspended state. It wasn't quite death, but it was just this weird NDE experience where she was just enveloped in light, not white, again, just like this bright light where she was kind of like, what do I do?
Had her heart stopped?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, no,
okay,
she
so
coded.
There's no way that she should have consciously known this. No blood to the brain. There's no way she should have heard any of this or seen any of this from the ceiling, especially.
She, So when the doctors were arguing, she was coding on the table. She was dead when the doctors were arguing. They were arguing whether or not, like, what they were doing was correct. Because they were like, we should give her this, we should give her that. Like, whatever medicines or, like, I have no healthcare background, so I don't know what they were arguing about. But they were trying to give her certain things to bring her back, to help her. And she had no idea. She didn't even care that they were arguing at the time. Like, she just saw they were yelling at each other. And she's like, oh, she looked down and they were arguing below and she saw her body and then woke up and was alive. And the nurse said they did, in fact, argue days later. Like, oh, yeah, like they did argue because you died and they were arguing about the treatment. So wow. It was weird.
That is weird. And, you know, you might want to go on YouTube and watch some of those IANDS.
Yeah.
IANDS. They're short, you know, they're 10, 15 minutes long.
But, I want to look into that, actually. I didn't even know that was an organization.
Sure. No,
I've looked at Reddit, but
I will take that down, actually, because I love hearing stories like that, because I have no idea what's going on. I'm not going to pretend I do. I would love to know. I don't think anyone really knows, but I want to get as much information as possible, because I don't know what's going on in the world or when you die or...
That is why we have these conversations.
Exactly.
Trying to figure shit out.
It's the biggest question there is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Terry, I know it's getting late over there. If you want to plug your social medias or your where to find your book or anything else.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. It's almost 7:30. I'm so sorry.
I know. I'm trying to keep track of time. But...
Yeah, no, I've been enjoying the conversation. We
appreciate it, too. I'm sorry. I know you're about to talk, but I'm so completely honored that you came on our little podcast because, again, your book was the first book I bought after hearing it on a podcast, and I read it and told literally every single person I know about it.
Thank you so much. That's very kind, and I appreciate that more than you know.
It's dead serious. I am very devoted to your story, and it's stuck with me for the almost 2.5 years that you've put it out there, and I'm very excited to read your next book.
Yeah, it's actually your book was the first alien abduction book I've ever purchased, I think.
Yeah, we usually watch TV at night, and I was like, we're reading these books, and I was like, we're not watching a show tonight. Here, you read this. I'm reading Incident at Devil's Den, okay? And that's what we did.
I love it. Well, you guys should shoot me your mailing address, and I'll send you a signed copy of my new book.
For sure. Absolutely. And we'll totally, what's it called? So we can plug it?
It's called Devil's Den, The Reckoning.
Okay.
Ooh, nice.
Yes, I'm so excited.
Yeah, I thought it was a nice ring to it.
Do you have any way people can contact you, or do you have social media?
Yes.
Okay.
I have a website that I'm embarrassed to say I don't maintain, but I've got some cool photographs posted to it.
We saw it. So is it the terrylovelace.com?
TerryLovelace.com, yes. And my book, I have a book, the cheapy Kindle version, and then I did an audiobook in my own voice, for better or worse. I was told to hire a voice artist, but heavy price voice artist, I mean, you know.
Nah, fuck that, do yourself.
No, that's cheesy. Do your own voice.
I
yeah.
Really, I want it to be in my words.
Heck yeah.
my books are only on Amazon. It's Incident at Devil's Den. I appreciate you guys' kind comments. I think it's a pretty good read.
So, oh, it's great.
It's amazing. And all the
and my new book should be out in 10 days.
Oh, perfect.
10 days?
And that'll be on Amazon as well. 10 days. 10 days for the book in print and the Kindle, and then probably another month before I get the audiobook recorded.
Okay.
Awesome.
So, that's awesome. And the old book, but Incident at Devil's End has all your x-rays and the pictures in it, right?
It does. It has the x-rays, pictures of the bruises, a drawing of the craft, which I think is pretty cool to see.
Well, you had some weird stuff, like that weird thing that had like wires coming out of it, and then like the weird circles in your knee.
Those are still there.
What are they? Can someone take them out and tell you?
Here's the deal. I would love to have them out. But I can't get a cardiac clearance letter because of my heart problems.
No surgeon
will touch me.
Dude, do you ever just want to take him out and be like, all right, I'm getting a degree in this shit so I can figure it out. Like, that's in your own body. Don't you want to know?
Just take a scalpel to your knee.
I, you know, I, I thought about driving down to Tijuana because I guarantee I can find a Mexican surgeon.
You for sure could.
It would probably be like $50 too. It'd be a lot cheaper than up here.
Yeah, all right, but Terry. You might die. Yeah. So.
Thank you so much for coming on our little show, and I'll send you the link if you want later if you want to listen to your own voice. I don't listen to my own podcast, so I don't care either way.
I talked a lot on this one. I usually don't talk, but I was really excited to talk to you, so I'm so sorry. I probably interrupted you a lot.
Oh, you did. Thank you so much. You guys are both so kind. Shoot me your mailing address, and I'll get you a copy of my book. As soon as I get a copy in my hand, I'll get to the post office and priority mail you one.
Hell awesome. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Have a good night.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.